Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
A pause now in our breathless day after Super Tuesday political coverage. The Supreme Court will begin hearing oral arguments today in Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt. In 2013, the state legislature passed a law requiring abortion clinics to employ at least one doctor with admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. It was a law in Texas. Other more dangerous procedures don't have this restriction. Colonoscopies, for example, have a much higher mortality rate than abortions, and doctors performing them say they don't need to have admitting privileges. Texas legislators, though, insist the standards are necessary to protect women. It's an argument that constitutes a workaround of a constitutional principle that abortion under Roe v. Wade is still legal. Alice Kessler-Harris is a historian at Columbia University and says there is a long history of rationalizing female inequality with laws supposedly designed to protect women.
What the defendants are arguing is that women who get abortions are in need of protection by the state, and that the state needs to protect them from clinics that are not, in their view, adequately funded and equipped, and that it also needs to protect them from people who, in their view, are inadequate doctors. Now, we know from the medical community that these efforts to so-called protect women draw on the notion that women are in need of a kind of supervision or protection that has long gone by the wayside, and that for many women, there would be the need to travel hundreds of miles to get services which are perfectly legal and constitutional. And therefore, asking them to do this is an undue burden.
How does this particular case arise out of laws and practices and precedents that come really from the workplace?
It stems back to 1908, where a rather famous court case named Muller v. Oregon declared that women could, in fact, be protected at work. And the reason to protect them, the court says, is because they are the mothers of the race or the future mothers of the race, and that therefore the health and well-being of the next generation lay in their hands. And since that was the case, all of society had a stake in the general welfare of women. And under those circumstances, the state had a right to pitch in to limit the freedom of employers to exploit women, to work them too many hours a day or to work them until they were too tired and so on. Some women actually benefited from that protective labor legislation for a number of years in that they got shorter hours and so on. But in fact, the long-term effect was to limit women to certain kinds of jobs, which did not require this kind of legislative protection or where employers could handle legislative protection. So the short-term effects might seem to have been good for women, but the long-term effect was to deny women opportunity in the labor force.
Is the doctrine of treating women differently than men in the workplace outmoded now and would never apply in an actual workplace case, unlike this case?
It is outmoded now, and it has been outmoded since the late 1960s and early 1970s. When the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission made the decision that protective labor legislation for women only was in fact illegal or unconstitutional. And that decision has been long since upheld. So for the last 45 or 50 years, the idea of special protection for women in the workplace has given way to the notion that if workers need protection, then all workers need protection, not just female workers.
How does the Texas law take an outmoded doctrine and turn it into a tactic for advancing the cause of the anti-abortion movement and expect that to be upheld in the courts?
I think that outmoded doctrine, that is, that women need protection, is deeply ingrained in American law and culture. Stemming back to the 18th century, the notion was that women, especially married women, came under the cover of their fathers or their husbands, that they were not persons in their own right, and that they were better represented by the male heads of families. And that notion, even though we've eliminated it in most of our laws, is nevertheless deeply ingrained in American culture. It took all of the 1970s and many Supreme Court cases for laws to be changed so that women didn't have to live where their husbands lived, so that they could legally change their names and or not change their names and continue to use their own names. Despite the fact that the laws have now changed, there's still a kind of sense that manliness or masculinity resides in a male's capacity to support a family. And if that can't happen, then what will a man be? What will a family be? So though we've changed the laws, there's a little bit, I think, of our cultural heritage that still persists in identifying women as weaker, more dependent, less able to support themselves, less able to make judgments for themselves. And it's that bit, I think, that's reflected in the Texas laws.
Alice Kessler-Harris is author of Out to Work, A History of Wage-Earning Women in the United States. She's professor of American history at Columbia University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.